You all are wondering what happened. Well, here's what happened. We've had a coup. I'm taking over. Actually, I think it may say in your bulletin, I don't know, that Fred was to be with us this morning. He was a part of the coup too, but he wasn't feeling well. So I'm happy to be working with Lauren as usual. And we have with us this morning James Franklin, who is the campus and young adult missioner. He has offices at Wake Forest, but he goes lots of places, and we're grateful for his being with us. Dixon had the opportunity to take a few days with his family, since the kids are out of school, I think, for a few days next week. And so he and his family are off on a little trip. And Sarah and Mark went to a conference. I think it was a church musicians conference, and Sarah went with him. So they're in two different spots. Actually, they will come back here and get up with Sally Dudley, and they'll all go to a conference. And so this week, don't have any problems. Okay? Give an old man a break. You know, I love that reading from the Hebrew Bible, from Leviticus. I'm not generally a great fan of Leviticus, but that was just good stuff. And what it reminded me of is how long it's been that God's people, in trying to be faithful to God, have been concerned about justice. I mean, this is not new. this justice stuff we talk about Sunday after Sunday is not new. It's just that we've been trying to do it a long time and we ain't got it right yet. So we just got to keep trying. So Jesus, following in that same line of thinking, taught today. And he says something about an old understanding of dealing with conflict in human relationships. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. He starts talking about that. Now, commentators on Matthew's gospel have pointed out that the principle of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that was originally intended to be restrictive, not permissive. Think about that. It was designed to restrain blood vengeance by fixing strict limitations on revenge and retaliation. Well, I don't know how it worked for the ancients, but I do know how it works for us. Wasn't it Gandhi who said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth will result eventually in the whole world being toothless and blind? Well, it is true that practicing this perceived method of justice in human relationships results in everyone losing sight of what is truly important about the things that are broken, and that is that broken things be restored, be brought back into unity, and that justice somehow be orderly. But we have a lot of experience with what I'll call retaliative justice. That's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I think it just comes naturally. He pulled my hair, I'm pulling his hair. He stole my iPad, I'll steal his iPad. She spread a rumor about me, I'll spread a rumor about her. They painted words on our school building, we're going to paint words on their school building. Or they gerrymandered the districts when they were in office, so we're going to do it when we get in office. I'm just saying that to see if y'all are awake. They placed a tariff on our exports, we'll place a tariff on theirs. They bombed us, we'll bomb them. An eye for an eye. To quote a phrase a politician we no longer see much of used to use. How's that working out for you? I am an equal opportunity employer. You realize probably there never really is an eye for an eye. There's rarely an equal equation here. It seems like somebody eventually has to add a little unique twist. Well, not only did they paint our school, but we're painting their school and their buses too. Things begin to escalate. And soon the problem and the actions and the consequences become more severe or more harmful or more expensive. There's no better illustration of this than the two wars in which we are still enmeshed. Afghanistan and Iraq are longest wars in our history. It seemed so simple when they started. We think they did this to us, so we're going to go and make them pay. We'll get the folks that made this happen, and then we'll come home and we'll be justified and all will be well. Of course, now we know it certainly was more complicated than that, wasn't it? It wasn't the way we thought it was going to be. And particularly in the war in Iraq, we found out that the reasons we went weren't even actually real reasons. They served somebody else's agenda. And it's been an absolutely huge tragedy of universal proportions. It has added to the destabilization of the entire Middle East. What we almost always forget, it seems, is that once retaliation occurs, the entire conflict takes on a life of its own, usually resulting in far greater consequences and pain even than the precipitating event that got us there in the first place. That's been true for every war we've fought. So it is, I think, that Jesus is on to something this morning. The problem is that what he's on to is revolutionary. It is countercultural, and it's very, very scary. He is proposing an entirely new paradigm for dealing with human conflict. It's counterintuitive. It's counter the status quo. It's counter, but we've always done it this way before. It's truly radical. Jesus is saying that we're supposed to try to behave like God wants us to behave. That's why he says this ridiculous thing at the end of today's gospel: be perfect as God is perfect. Now, believe me, Jesus knew that you weren't going to be perfect. But he gave us something to shoot for. We're supposed to try to be godlike in our response to each other, individually and collectively. We're supposed to have love as a guiding principle. Come down, O love divine. Beautiful words, wonderful tune. And so we hear today Jesus talking, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the left. Give to everyone who begs from you. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Now, my experience with trying to preach and teach about this gospel, my experience has been, what shall I say? Maybe not so good. You clergy are so naive. What planet do you live on? Get real. This is the real world. I don't want to hear politics from the pulpit. You clergy are going to get my son killed. That was from a father who had a son stationed in Iraq. I didn't know our sermons were that powerful. We could kill somebody halfway around the world. But anyway, those responses came from sermons. They weren't all mine, but some were, that I would have considered as thoughtful, maybe even tepid, certainly not in your face, and without rhetoric, and theologically very mainline. But boy, oh boy, do they ever strike a visceral chord with people. You may be getting mad now. It seems that we have a huge emotional investment in an eye for an eye when it comes to looking at national and international issues and warfare. And I will admit, it's counterintuitive to respond or suggest a pacific response to something like 9/11. It feels so wimpy or unreal. But I want us to examine a few things, because we can probably all agree it's not always working out so well. So I'd like for us just to examine a few things this morning. First, personally, I would like to suggest that we try to respond to small disappointments in ways that might be different from the way we've been doing it. I would like to suggest that we try not to hurt, to hold on to a hurt or a grudge or a resentment, but that we work at being loving to the persons whose actions or words have hurt or disappointed us. I do not mean for you, however, to stuff your feelings, because that's not healthy. What I recommend to you is that you go and tell the person what it is they have done and describe their behavior that hurt you and how that hurt you. What was the tangible effect for you on what they did? I want you to do that without expectation. Say it and leave it, and let the other person take responsibility for how they wish to respond. But do not retaliate. Have another idea. On the week of the annual meeting, I preached, and I had a rather long story, which I won't have for you today, about a situation that happened in a cancer research laboratory in Michigan State. And the head of the laboratory, a physician and also a PhD in clinical research, had a problem with a doctoral student who came to her saying that she thought somebody was tampering with her research. And so she was kind of unsure about what to do about that, the head of that department, and so she was talking to some other colleagues. And the first thing her other colleague said is, you know, it often happens that the person who brings this is actually doing it themselves, because maybe things aren't working out so well and they're trying to save face. And so that planted a seed with this person. And as things moved up the line and she went to campus security, they said the same thing. We'll be glad to look into it, but you need to know that often it happens that it's actually the person themselves that are causing this. And so eventually they decide that they're going to have to get the local police involved, so they went off the campus, bringing in the outside authorities, and they worked with a detective, and they made a list of all the people that might have it in for this particular student and might have it in for this particular department head, because it would make her look bad, of course. But the detective working on it said, you do know, of course, that oftentimes the person that brings this up. So it turns out that they put in cameras, hidden cameras. And guess what? It wasn't the person who brought it up. It was somebody else, a postdoctoral student. I mean, the guy already had a PhD, for God's sake, who, when confronted, said, I just felt she was going too fast and I needed to slow her down. Well, we could talk about that a long time. In any event, what the head of the lab said in her article, that she learned a great deal from this experience, because so many people had already convicted this young woman for something she didn't do. She said, you know what? We need to test what we believe, not just trust it. And when I read that statement, I said, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I wonder how that might apply to the work that we're in. We need to test what we believe, not just trust it. You know, it is so easy to say that you're going to see Christ in every person and treat every human being with dignity and all those things in the baptism. Isn't that easy to say? You say, I will with God's help. I'll do that. Well, how do you test it? Well, what I think about this gospel is it's a perfect opportunity for us to test whether or not the Jesus way might work. You can actually test whether or not you believe this gospel. I know you're going to say you believe it and you're going to trust that it's true. But the only way you will know is how you alter your own behavior and see if you get a different result. So I want to thank that scientist for that wonderful insight. Another thing, of course, is considering the huge toll in human life and property and all those things that warfare causes. Why don't we just commit ourselves to praying daily for peace in the world and for the leaders of the nations and the nations we don't like and we're not getting along with in particular? Pray that we all can find alternatives to violence for solving problems. Now, I will admit to being naive and not having all the worldly experiences that many have had, but I must say this morning that the reason Jesus' methods for dealing with conflict have not worked, primarily, is that they have not been tried. They have been found too radical and not acceptable to the status quo. One source I came across said, Jesus isn't asking for us to be doormats. Jesus is asking us to find creative, nonviolent ways forward in difficult situations. In fact, Jesus' admonitions in Matthew are not as passive as they might seem. What they do actually is reframe the response into one that opens more possibilities for positive outcomes. They informed greatly the nonviolent strategy of the civil rights movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King. And believe me, that was effective. As one writer put it, this was far from being merely passive. King understood that this new approach of the kingdom, you know, preachers are supposed to be bringing in the kingdom, this new approach to that, a fresh power emerges through Jesus' righteousness, one that has the potential to lay bare the core issues at stake and even to topple social structures like unjust laws, making ways for greater justice. It is this revolutionary obedience to which Jesus calls us. A few weeks back, I quoted G.K. Chesterton as saying, the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. I still believe that is true. However, Chesterton, well, he said a lot of things, but he also said this, and I love it. Chesterton said, let your religion be less of a theory and more of a love affair. A love affair. That's right. Jesus is about a love affair. I think he was on to something. Jesus, loving Jesus and loving each other is indeed a love affair. So like the old Nike commercial said, it's a love affair. Just do it. Amen.